Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So in the Media Project this week, an opportunity for some commentary, analysis, and even some insight into the media issues of the week. And we will reveal to you later on the most popular item ever on WSJ.com, the Wall Street Journal. So stand by for that, ladies and gentlemen.
Whoa,
Smith, editor, what a tease.
I tell you, this is like professional radio here, you know? You know, we know how to do this stuff. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. And here's next to me in the studio, Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Oh, it is nice to be here today.
It is great to see you. It's been a while. And Dr. Alan Shartok, whom we cannot see, actually.
He's lost so much weight, he's gotten actually invisible.
Invisible. He's just faded away to nothing there in his posh studio deep in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts with his elevated ankle. Sir.
A lot of snow out there. You know, in the old days, I used to have to go out and do the shoveling. Now with a busted ankle, you can't do that. So others have been doing it for me, including my next door neighbor, Ron, who's been very nice with his snowblower. I only say that because I want to encourage him to do more.
Shout out to Ron.
Yeah, all right, Ron, way to go. That's great. Let's just hope that he doesn't get your local newspaper caught in his snowblower, which we hear a lot about. You know, actually, our circulation department reports, when we got a new circulation director, he said, you know, the snowblowers in this town are more expensive than any anywhere else, because people are always writing in and saying, your paper got stuck in a snowdrift and it destroyed my snowblower, which is worth $2,000. And, you know,
wow,
come on, people.
That's a great story, Rick. I never thought of that.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. Okay. Anyway, so the president's new budget is out and it guts, in fact, eliminates the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So, Alan, let's let you go first as the CEO of one of the major public radio outlets in the U.S. of A. What do you think about this?
Well, as Alan used to say to his twin brother, Lewis, when we were very young, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. I told you so. I told you this was coming. I got all these letters from people who say, you're making it up. Oh, really? As Mario Cuomo used to say to us, Rex. Oh, really? But it does turn out that at least symbolically it's on the table. Now, I think the humanities and all the other stuff that they're dealing with, which are worth no more than a dot on the page in terms of the budget, will be used as fodder in some cases, because don't forget that a lot of the boards of these stations are made up of outstanding Republicans who are going to be writing and saying to their congressmen, you can't do this. This would be terrible. And I truly believe that Trump, of course, hates public radio. I do. Unlike him, it tells the truth. And so I do think that it represents a tremendous, tremendous problem for the public radio stations around the United States. And that's all I got to say.
Well, and it's not just the public radio stations. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting provides a substantial amount of funding to television stations, to important journalism efforts, including, you know, shows like Frontline. We're talking about, you know, again, just like WAMC, your radio station, Alan, there is a substantial amount of money they raise from their listeners, from their members. But this government subsidy is important. But you face this issue as well at the state level, right, Alan?
We do. The state gives us a much, much smaller amount of money. Somewhere, I believe now, and don't hold me to it, between $30,000 and $50,000 out of the $7 million budget. And that's just for this radio station. Each station is evaluated differently according to a formula. But there's no way the state could possibly step up and make up for what the feds have done, because they're going to have their own problems because Trump is after much of their budgets, meals on wheels. You ask me a question, and I always get into trouble for saying this, But if you ask me whether Meals on Wheels should get the money before public radio, which can do for itself, the answer is, of course. Every time I say that, my colleagues around the country hear about it, and they yell at me, but of course, look, if it's Meals on Wheels for seniors who can't eat otherwise, or our doing what we did on that one day fabulous fun drive, then the answer is obvious, isn't it?
Well, yes. And in fact, I think people would agree that feeding the destitute elderly or the people who are shut in is probably that. But the problem isn't really for WAMC, which, as you pointed out, has access because of the size of its audience and your skill as a fundraiser to lots and lots of money from your listeners. The problem is the little stations in rural areas out across the country, including Trump country. It's the small public radio stations that provide identity to communities who cannot otherwise support themselves.
As you know, Rex, I have said so 1,000 times right here on this show. You are absolutely right. You're brilliant. And it is those stations that are really in the worst kind of trouble.
Right. Also, if in fact the budget does cut funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities, one of the ways that will also affect public broadcasting is that a lot of the performers who show up and do shows, for example, at the Linda, derive some funding from grants that derive it from NEH and NEA. And as Judy pointed out, that constitutes only 0.003% of federal spending. That is 0.003% of federal spending is the NEA and the NEH combined. And yet that would have a disproportionate effect, I think, on the artistic life of the country. But you don't think, Alan, it's actually going to happen. You think these members of Congress are going to say, no, no, let's keep the funding going because we've got NPR stations and PBS stations in our constituencies.
You know, it's a tough one, Rex, because in the past, before, when they had Obama as the president, they did this. The House of Representatives tried to get rid of public broadcasting as we know it. Now, I don't know, Rex, whether what they wanted was the issue to say, okay, you know, we're good Republicans, we want to get rid of left-wing or moderate public radio, or whether they really meant it. Because we're going to see now that when their actions will result in the change, whether they really meant it before when they said they wanted it, but knew they couldn't have it. Get it?
But what do you think of the whole concept of government-funded journalism?
I think it's risky.
So what do you do to protect yourself?
Well, what we did, Judy, as you know, here at WAMC, the host of this radio show, was we said to the people in the last fund drive, and we had the most incredible fund drive, we had a one-day million-dollar fund drive with 500,000 of it in the so-called lockbox the couple of weeks leading up to the actual one-day fund drive. But we raised more money than ever before. But we also stepped aside and said, give us a third of what the federal government gives to us, and we'll put it in a First Amendment fund. And each drive will put another third in, so if they take the money away, we'll be able to do it. But then Rex will come back and say, well, but not everybody is you, Alan. Not everybody can do that, but they sure should try. And the other thing that's really annoying me, as long as you've got me revved up on this,
yeah, I'm sorry
is
about that.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry.
there are people in the public radio community who are beginning to eat their young. What they're doing is saying,
God,
perhaps we shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah. No, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting says you can't be an advocate and you can't do this and you can't say that. And maybe we're doing that. Come on now. Will you give me a break?
Hold on. Now, just take a deep breath there, Alan. I know you've sworn off caffeine, but this is...
It doesn't sound
what do you
like
mean
it.
People are eating their young in public broadcasting? I don't understand what that's a reference to.
Well, there are public broadcasters, believe it or not, who think that if you can satisfy Trump and others and some of the right-wing Republicans by pulling back and being less confrontational and not speaking, because then you're really running into the First Amendment issues. But they are. There are people who write me all the time and say, what's NPR doing? I think NPR, not WAMC, but NPR, I'm finding them to be much more sort of pro-Republican than they used to be.
Well, I think that's a libel. I think that's a slander of NPR. I don't think that's true at all. I haven't heard that. I do hear them trying to be fair journalists, but I think they're aggressively reporting, and I'd like to see some examples of how they're being too pro-Republican. If you're going to malign NPR News, which your station
carries,
I'm not
maligning anybody.
You
I'm
are
telling,
indeed.
I'm you're, telling no, Rex, you're wrong, and stop.
This sounds just like Donald Trump. Make the accusation with nothing to back it up.
No,
you know, how about... who was taping your telephone?
Well, what
now?
If I hey, Rex, what if I show you the letters from people who are complaining about NPR? Then would you apologize to me on bended knee?
No, you're the one who said you think that NPR not...
No, I said I've been getting letters.
Oh,
that's what I said.
Oh, I see.
Go back in the tape and you'll hear
reference.
It. Yeah, right.
Okay, now we understand. We thought that you were maligning NPR News. That's the editorial week.
Never.
Judy and I can say that since
in the audience.
Yeah, we're the editors and the audience. Yeah, but whatever. By the way, here's a quote check. Who said this? Who said this golden quote? By the way, some of the finest people I know are reporters. Reporters are wonderful. Who said that?
Was it Donald Trump?
It was Donald Trump.
What a
absolutely.
Nice guy.
What isn't that swell? Unless they're part of the enemies of the people. But Donald Trump, in his interview with Tucker Carlson on Fox News, Carlson asked him about Twitter, and he went on and explained, the media is so unfair, and he specifically cited the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN. So those in particular, he said, are evil, but maybe some of the rest of us are not. Enemies of the people.
Rex, at the cost of unleashing your snerddom again, I want to say.
What is snerddom? Is that truly, a word?
Isn't he the guy who works for Rush Limbaugh?
You never heard of a snerd?
No,
snerd? Snerddom comes from snerd.
I learn something every day.
Yeah, well, good. Put that into the vocabulary. Okay. But what I was going to say is that, and I've said this before, Judy, before in other venues, I think that Trump is now, by going on with Tucker Carlson on Fox, he really is in a bunker. Because when he names the New York Times, the failing New York Times, and the Washington Post, and goes after each and every one of them and says, okay, the only place I can go now is I'll get 20,000 people at a stadium and I'll do another campaign rally, or I'll go on Tucker Carlson and Fox where Murdoch is my friend, that puts him in a bad spot. Bunker is the key word.
Yeah, but it hasn't really hurt him. He's been isolated before, we've thought, and he seems to do just fine from his bunker, you know? It seems
but if you look
at the reporting from around the country, the reporters who have gone out to Trump country and talked to people who voted for Donald Trump in the heartland, those states that he carried unexpectedly, the Trump supporters are not waning in their support for him. Their disappointment is that the media and the Congress aren't supporting him enough. They believe him. I don't know that he's been hurt with his core supporters at all.
So, Alan, are you thinking that he's afraid to go out and talk to the...
Yes. Let's look at the examples. In the old days, during the campaign, you'd turn on Morning Joe, who is not a left-wing liberal, right? And there he would be. He'd be talking to them. He'd be talking to CNN. He'd be all those other places. He's not there right now. Right now, all he's doing is bunkering down with Tucker Carlson, which is a disgusting thought.
Well, back then, he was campaigning for office, too. Now he's got the office. He needs to go out and get support for his proposals, but he doesn't need to get voters anymore. Remember,
and you don't think the media helps?
Yeah, remember President Obama wasn't exactly accessible to the media in his term as well. I mean, he did the TV shows, but it was very hard for the print journalists to get any time with him, any valuable time with him.
Now, in terms of a new low in that regard, consider the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, whose previous experience, of course, has been as an oil company executive when he didn't have any need to talk to the media. Of course, Rex Tillerson is heading off to Asia, and he's going to travel to Beijing, Seoul, and Tokyo for key meetings. But the only reporter who will be on his plane is a guy from the International Business Journal, IBJ, which I remember reading a profile of a couple of years ago. It's just a weird right-wing, it verges on alt-right. Of course, typically when a Secretary of State travels like a president, key members of the media travel with him. There's always a media pool reporter available. And this is so that if something big happens, you need to have the press there to report it to the world. Secretary of State is an important figure. But this is what happens, I guess, when you put federal agencies into the hands of people who have neither experience in government nor respect for the role of government being accessible to the public.
And this isn't just the press whining about losing a perk. This is an essential way for them to cover an important action by the administration. They can't just get there on their own by taking a commercial flight and having that kind of access. They need basic access. It's not the whole press corps. It doesn't have to be the whole press corps, but it certainly has to be more than one specially chosen reporter by the administration.
Right. Maybe we've seen the video of Andrea Mitchell of NBC News trying to get a question to the Secretary of State in some of his photo ops, and the man looks like he doesn't speak. There is some question as to whether he might be mute at this point, because here's Andrea Mitchell desperately trying to ask a question of him and getting people standing in front of her camera, physically shoving her around to get her out of there. Of course, the tweets from the Trump administration are that she was being whiny, pushy. Those women.
Yeah, but it seems like there's a basic misunderstanding about their obligation to talk to the press or to talk to the public, because it's not just talking to the press. When you talk to the press, you're talking to the public.
Exactly.
Well, they don't believe that. They believe that the press is out to get them, and therefore they're not going to talk to the press. And there's a certain amount of logic to that. I mean, can you imagine if Andrea Mitchell was allowed to ask Rex Tillerson, how do you feel about your entire budget for the Department of State being cut by 23% or something like that? They don't want to give answers to that.
Yeah, very true. So if you're just joining us, this is The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. Alan Shartok, the CEO of WAMC, and Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. Here's a question that Judy and I can get a little bit into. And Alan, you can wait your turn.
You shut, Alan, and you shut up.
Here's a question posed by Rick Edmonds at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, which is, are daily opinion pages headed to the morgue? Well, morgue is what we used to call our archives, our clips, but actually I think he means, are they being deep-sixed? But the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, typically one of the great newspapers in America, although they have just been acquired by Gannett, so I guess we can say goodbye to that. But in any case...
Ooh, how dare you go after Gannett? What a wonderful...
It is just, you know, it's just, I'm just looking at history. Look at what Gannett has done to terrific newspapers. They're doing it right now to the Record in northern New Jersey. It used to be called the Bergen Record. They're just tearing the place apart. So the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And the Poughkeepsie Journal's going down.
Yeah, well, they have certainly shrunk, and including the elimination of the job of our dear friend, the editor there, Stushinsky, often before these microphones. So here's the question. They're getting rid of the opinion page most days of the week at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And the question is this a valid decision? Judy, what do you think?
What a sad development, because I strongly believe that the opinion page is one of the fundamental services we provide our community. We give people a chance to vent their opinion. We offer commentary, opinion, and our editorials, which are, I was so disillusioned when I read that, because they are clearly dropping it because they don't think the audience is there.
Right. Not enough eyeballs on those pages. Right. But the question might be, what is the value of them, even if they're read by fewer people? Which is true. They're read by fewer people than the comics. But there still is great value to offering these things. You know, one of the things I like best about your opinion page, actually, is the interactive nature of this. Do you run it weekly?
High notes.
Yeah. And you invite people to call in with things that are good that are happening in the community, and you run about six or seven of them at once, and little snippets. And I like two things about that. First, it does focus public attention on the things that are good. And I always tell people, news is deviations from the normal, and so naturally most news is bad news, because generally we live in a society where good things happen. But it's probably true that because we're focused on news, we don't write enough about good stuff. So that's good. But the second good thing is you're interacting with people. You're saying, tell us what you know. And then I presume your editorial page editor checks stuff out before passing it along.
Yes, indeed. Uh-huh. But some of the best writing in journalism today is in the opinion in the editorial section. I mean,
yes.
And in some of the most developed, sophisticated thinking. And at a time when we're really looking at government and trying to hold them accountable, this kind of sophisticated writing is crucial. I'm curious to see what they replace their opinion page with.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, papers like the one that I write for on the weekends, the Berkshire Eagle, they take a couple of sentences, and instead of having a long editorial, which they have, they'll say, this is what's going to be said in the editorial. You do that too, Rex, right?
Yeah, we have the issue and the consequences, or whatever the word is.
A little synopsis.
Yes.
And then right next to the editorials usually are the letters to the editor. And the letters to the editor, I believe, still, Rex, are one of the most read parts of the paper. So if your eyes just go a little to the left, you'll see the editorial. And sometimes
pardon the expression.
Sometimes
a little to the left, yes.
Yeah, right. I choose my words carefully.
Exactly.
So, but the letters to the editor are still one of the major ways that people communicate with people in their community about things.
You know, if the opinion page goes, what's next? You have to wonder whether, is it, you know, international news that doesn't get a lot of eyeballs? Is it national news, which is getting eyeballs now, but maybe it wouldn't? We're in the service economy. This is our service industry. We've got to do some things that people aren't necessarily going to love or read.
Absolutely.
Well, is it possible that the reason these editorials are being eliminated is that because you have to have an editorial writer who writes them, or several editorial writers who write them, and it's all money saving?
I'm sure that's it. Yeah, the Journal Sentinel in Milwaukee is saying, well, no, we're going to do the same amount of work. We're going to put it online. It'll be digital editorials, an assortment of blogs, newsletters, video and events, and so on. But I am dubious about that, frankly, that they will actually have the same number of people. I'm sure it's financial savings. Absolutely. Now, here's a great thing. This is completely off the wall, but we're going to take now a little look at Langley, Washington, where there is a paper called The South Whidbey Record. The South Whidbey Record had a reporter who interviewed the city attorney, and a result of it is the mayor of Langley, Washington, billed the newspaper $64 for the cost of having to have the city attorney speak to the reporter. You know, I have a feeling that some taxpayers will probably like this idea.
I know, just when you think you've heard everything. Although, I mean, we have had municipalities try to charge us for the lawyer's time to review a Freedom of Information request. That we have challenged that and said that's not appropriate. But I have never been billed to talk to an attorney. But they make the argument that the attorney is being paid by the hour. This is a freelance or a contract position, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it did cost them, but I would hope that that would be part of the contract or the retainer.
Similar kind of instance actually comes up. We need clarity in the state of New York about being able to copy public documents. Most places will not allow you to use your cell phone to make a copy of a document that they let you look at. Instead, they'll charge you a certain amount per page. Now, this, in terms of today's technology, this makes no sense. And we have reporters who will routinely take their cell phone with them, and if they look at a document, they will shoot a picture of it. You know, you save, nowadays people are sometimes charging $1 a page for a copy or something like that. But that is yet to be clarified by statute, right? Whether public entities can get away with that. So we'll see.
Right. It's a good source of revenue. Probably not a huge source of revenue, but I think they don't want to give it up.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, as we come towards the end of the show, I promised that we would talk about
what has
turned out to be the number one story ever on WallStreetJournal.com. Can you imagine what it was?
No.
Was it a list of some sort?
No, actually, it was a story about a posting showing a video of the analyst in Korea whose children came running into the room with him as he was on live TV. This is an American
guy.
I
saw it.
You saw that? Wasn't that funny? This guy
I saw it several thousand times, yeah.
Yes, exactly. The guy was doing a live shoot, and of course, nowadays, a lot of this is done from people's homes because the camera technology allows it. And he was talking about the political crisis in South Korea. He lives in Korea, an American, with his Korean wife. And as he was there in front of his little map of the world behind him in his nice study at home, his suit on, his wild little children came running in. First, a little four-year-old girl who was hyped up from her birthday party, and then her little brother in a stroller. And then the wife came trying to get the kids out, and they couldn't. It was actually adorable. But it shows us how the new media world actually is bringing us a little closer together and making us a little more human. So that's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, that's an excellent point.
I have no idea why it became such an important story. I didn't think it was any big deal. But boy, people around the world, I mean, it became an international story.
Don't you have a cute little grandson you could pull out now?
I do. And he would make more sense than Rex. I'll tell you that right now. And he's only 3 years old.
So we got to go. We got to go at this point before the insults get further. That's Alan Shartok, deep in the Berkshires, Judy Patrick and Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
To get a living wage, they joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Judy Patrick is the editor of the Daily Gazette. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough.